start, but we Khangubane Ms. Dumiyeni, the former SAA board chairperson. We wrote several letters to her. She responded yesterday by calling, and she said to us she is not available to come personally to them to the committee inquiry. She is not well. Her doctor put her off. She is really apologizing. I'm talking now what she has said to me. Ne? It's not words that I have made up on my own. She said she really apologized for not coming. It's not as if she undermines the committee. She is looking forward to come and explain herself in the committee. But the doctor has said her as she is off sick, has set her off. She can't fly. She has to drive. And you can imagine driving from Joburg to Cape Town. It's a distance, which I thought it will also affect her health if she can drive that long distance. Even if she can be driven, just sitting in the car for such a long distance, it will make her more sick. I therefore said to her, I will report this to the committee. She has made submissions. She sent written submissions. And she thought that by writing and give and submit something written, that will at least be accepted by the committee. I therefore told her that that is not acceptable. We want to interact with her. We want to put questions on her, and we want her to respond on the spot. Then she really said she won't be able to come this week. And I said, I asked her yesterday to write everything down. I was expecting that I will get something from the secretary of the committee that is written. Apparently it did not arrive, because the letter she wrote sometime last week or a week before last also did not arrive in the system of the secretary. It arrived only Friday last week. So really it's a long distance from Joburg to Cape Town. Even emails take days to arrive in Cape Town. So that's the situation with Ms. Dumiyeni. Honorable members, I am putting you to you that Ms. Dumiyeni will not be able to come to the committee. She says she is not well. I said to her she must write, and I said she must attach the doctor's certificate if it is possible. I was expecting that to happen yesterday or today in the morning. For now, we haven't received anything. Honorable Swart, Honorable Luyenge, Honorable Mare, Honorable Malzedi, in that order.
Chair, thank you for the briefing, and we fully appreciate if a person is not well that they would normally provide a doctor's certificate to indicate that. But I'm a bit concerned if the indication is that she's indicating that she won't be well at all for the foreseeable future, or is it just the short term? I've briefly read the statement that she's provided, and it's basically a denial of Mr. Zolotsotsi's version of the meeting with the former president. And so we do have some documentation at our disposal, but I would agree with you that it is important for us to engage with her on the contents of her statement and to question her. And it's a pity we don't have that follow-up letter that you requested to indicate the nature of a medical condition and whether this is a long-term prognosis or a short-term prognosis. I would expect it's a short-term prognosis and therefore suggest that we give her the opportunity a week or 10 days to appear before us, Chair. Thank you.
Chairperson, I think in concurrence with the latter speaker, we have an obligation to do work here. And we have timelines against us. But also, it is our responsibility to execute our duty on a fairly and squarely basis. As the latter speaker is also a legal guru, it is only fair to, if we have not ascertained as to whether the illness is not going to take long, and we can only determine that when there is a doctor's certificate, then I agree that let us give her another chance of not more than of not more than 7 days. It must be the last next week. There is no more next week that we must have. Otherwise, we will have to summon people irrespective of medical conditions because we need to go and report about this to Parliament. It's not our own creation. Thanks.
Thank you. While you are engaging members, can we look at an option of going to her, to Joburg, as this inquiry, taking this inquiry to... No, don't respond now. You will respond when you are responding formally to me so that I record what you have said. And it's just something that has just come up in my mind right now, that if she can't fly, if she has to be in a stable place, it's not as if... She actually explains to me what type of sickness she has, but I cannot say it openly here. It's going to I will be grossly it's really private. I can't do that. But please, it's not as if she can't walk. It's not as if she cannot go to work where she works. The problem is long distance driving, and the problem is flying. That's what she said to me. She spoke about flying and the long distance that she has to drive. So that is why I'm saying, can we look at other options? Honorable Mare, it's your turn.
Thank you, Smart. Now, we really would love to see her. We really miss her. She must come here to the National Parliament. And she's used to be flying because she served as chairman of SAA, so she's used to fly. Give her 7 days, I think that's normal, to clear up what must be cleared up. And the flight is only 2 hours. So we would love to see her shortly. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I'm afraid I'm not going to be quite as diplomatic. I think it's very clear that this is nothing more than a cat and mouse game, which I don't appreciate. There's been ample opportunity for Ms. Mayeni to appear before our committee. We've given her more chances than I think anyone has been given without the issuing of a summons being the final port of call. You know, as someone who had a back fusion and then flew down to Cape Town 10 days later, let me tell you, I know how comfortable that can make you on an aeroplane when you're in a difficult situation. Chair, I don't buy this. I think that we are being taken for fools. I don't think any of us are fools, and we shouldn't allow that to happen. Chair, I absolutely insist that Ms. Mayeni appears before us. She must come to Cape Town. And, Chair, imagine the expense of flying this committee up to her, to wherever she is. And imagine if all the witnesses decide that they have a fear of flying, or they just dislike the car. We would be flying all around the country. Chair, this is a matter of national importance, and we are doing country duty here. Very serious allegations have been levied that need to be answered, and they need to be answered in this House, because this is where accountability takes place. So, Chair, I would strongly urge that we stop playing this little game with Ms. Mayeni, that she's attempting to play with us, and that she understands the game's up, and she will appear before this committee. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honourable Sadie.
I think you were right here to say a written submission will not be enough to represent her here in the inquiry. She definitely has to be here and come and answer quite a number of issues which have been raised about her. I don't think she understands the seriousness of this particular process. Without disregarding the issue of the condition. Because my take is that over and above coming to assist the committee to complete the work that we're doing, she must also understand this thing as an issue that is in her best interest to come and clear an A as well. But Siminish does not seem to be understanding it in that particular manner. I agree with my colleague who says we'll be setting a very wrong precedent to go to Johannesburg and go and interact with them. It can't be right. Let's agree with the route which says we're giving until next week, Wednesday. She must come in and interact with the committee. We definitely want to see her. And this thing is in her best interest as well. Thank you
very much, honourable members. Therefore, honourable members, are we saying here we give her a last chance up until next week, Wednesday? Is that what we are saying as this committee? Or she must come to the committee will not be able to go to her. She must come to the committee. She must also submit the doctor's certificate within 24 hours. Her written submission is not enough. We cannot ask questions on the on the paper she sent. She has to come and answer questions from the members. That's what the members, that's the mandate that you are giving me to send to Ms. Mien. Thank you very much, honourable members. Honourable members, there's another issue on the Minister of Home Affairs. You know, this change makes people to be confused. Today is Home Affairs, tomorrow is whatever. Honourable members, Mr. Gigaba, the Minister of Home Affairs and former Public Enterprise Minister, has asked for 10 days time to be given to him so that he is able to source the information from public enterprises and also to come with credible information in front of us so that he is not just taking out of his mind. He has something that is written that he will speak on. So he asked for 10 days. The 10 days that he asked, it was on Friday last week. Friday the 2nd of March last week. What is your take as members of this committee? Because I did not want to take a decision on my own. Honourable Luyeng and Honourable Mazwan.
Yeah, thanks, Chairperson. Without any waste of time, Chair, because of the the fact that when one is preparing for this, has to get some time. It is always good here for us to consider people who are not hell-bent to disrupt us. But seemingly this one, I am personally giving a benefit of doubt to the Honorable Minister that he might be doing that. I think this is a fair request that we must accept. 10 days is not a train smash. Let's allow him to do that.
Honorable Mazwa. Thank you, Chair. Yes, 10 days would make that the actually the 12th of March, which is next week, Monday. And given that we sit on Tuesday, it would be the 13th. Chair, I suggest that we send him a letter saying that this committee has taken into account the fact that he wants to gather information, which we appreciate, and that his 10 days would be up on the 12th of March, and therefore we'd like to see him on Tuesday the 13th. There's no cabinet meeting. It's a great day. 13 will be lucky for some, unlucky for others. Honorable Dlamini.
Well, thanks, Chairperson. You know, the good thing with time, it just keeps moving, so the 10 days is going to arrive. You know, just I think the 13th is fine. He must come because I think he has started in the wrong footing. He thought he's getting us somewhere with calling media briefings. So his thing is managing us. So let him come on the 13th so we can attend to it properly. Yeah.
Thank you, Honorable Members. That is also disposed. Honorable Members, on the 13th of March, we are meeting the Guptas and Associates. That is Tuesday next week. We have written a letter. We managed to get their lawyers. Kobani. But we managed to get their lawyers. We have given them the dates. So the Tuesday would be a little bit, we must prepare for going to Wednesday. We can deal with the minister on, remember, next week also we have house sittings. So we can take the minister, maybe one of them, either the Guptas or the minister on Tuesday. Then in the afternoon, we have a sitting on Wednesday. We might be seeing one of them also, either the Guptas or the minister. So we will be using again the 2 days next week, the Tuesday and the Wednesday. And I'm going to spend a meeting, A1. And those 2 days or one of those days might take us to the following day. You know, most you sit, you are used to sit from 9 this morning and up until 2 o'clock the following day or 3 o'clock the following day. So we must prepare ourselves for such situations. The name of the lawyer is Ahmed Ghanim, the lawyer of the Guptas. And you must remember, we said we want to see the Guptas and Associates. That's the and then in the Associates we mentioned Duduzan. I asked the secretary last week to write a letter separately to the Guptas and separately to Duduzan. Yo, ba go to Duduzan. To Duduzani, separate letters, two separate letters. So I hope he has done so, to because we will be doing, we know that they are associates, but we want them separately. We want to deal with their matters separately so that each of one takes an oath. If they want to take an oath, they take an oath separately so that we are able to interact with all of them. Thank you, Honorable Members. Honorable Luyenge, Honorable Tsedi, Honorable Swart.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. Though I would want to prefer the Guptas first, because we should have met them long ago. Let's appreciate here the work that we have done, colleagues, to make sure that they are here. So I would suggest that we see them first, but if the minister is only available on the day preceding that one of the cabinet is fine. So the 2 days is fine for the two groups of witnesses, the Tuesday and Wednesday, Chairperson. The Tuesday and Wednesday is fine for all of them, whoever comes first.
We should consider also the fact that Wednesday is a cabinet meeting. Yeah.
No, thanks, Chairperson. I think it's fine in that format. Let the Guptas come early. We run them unlimited time. Then let Madusi follow unlimited time as well. We'll finish in the morning. Because I think we're at the crunch of what we're dealing with now. So it's a final stretch. So let's go. There's no problem. We'll attend the cabinet. I don't think he contributes. So it's fine. He can even arrive late. So let's just go Tuesday, start with the Guptas, and then we'll follow with Mr. Kigaba, and then we'll finish it in that way. Thank you.
I'm partly covered here, but I thought you further clarify the issue of the SIPAT letter to Duduzan. The response that you gave us earlier from the lawyers, is that letter not clarifying the Duduzan issue? So I needed to clarify that particular aspect, whether the lawyers are not responding on behalf of Duduzan as well.
The letter to the Guptas is separate to the letter to Duduzani. The lawyers of Duduzani are separate people, are not the same lawyers that are with the Guptas. Remember, when we were to invite the Guptas, we said we invite the Guptas and associates. And when we mentioned the associate, we mentioned Duduzani as associate of the Guptas. Therefore, we don't want to lose that momentum. We want to deal with them at the same day, at the same time. If the other starts at 10, Duduzani, we might start with him at 2 o'clock or so, whatever. But we want to deal with them. We don't want to lose the focus on that day. Thank you very much. Honorable Swart.
Chair. Could you just give me clarity as to the response of the letter from the lawyers? Did they confirm that their clients will be here next week? Can I just have clarity, then I'd like to follow.
Mr. Swart, I can confirm that Mr. Ahmed Ghani did confirm that he is representing Mr. Atul Gupta, and he said that we made three letters for all three brothers. Then he said, I can send all of them to him. And then he said that he will make sure that they come. But we did send him a letter again yesterday to say that you must confirm attendance because we have sent him the letter already that other week. So I'm yet awaiting his email again to see that as to whether who is attending on the 13th.
I appreciate, Chair, there's a wonderful saying that hope springs eternal. And in this case, that they will appear next week. It's highly unlikely. But in the event that they do attend, that'll be good. In the event that they do not attend, should we not have someone else's backup? And you'll remember in December when we considered the associates, and I suggested that we should send letters and subpoenas to the brothers, Mr. Duduzane Zuma, Mr. Salim Essa, and Dr. Eric Woods. And in view of the fact that we've got severe time constraints, as soon as we know, well, we're not going to know until the day, but I can almost guarantee that we're not going to have the Guptas here next week. They're all over the country and the hawks are trying to find them. Should we not have a backup witness as well, so that we don't waste time? And in particular, my thoughts are towards Mr. Salim Essa, who features prominently in this inquiry. So it's just a thought to change.
Advocate Vanar, can you assist us on the issue of Salim Essa and Mr. Wood?
Thanks, Chair. Now, if the committee wants them, we could arrange that they appear. Yes.
Chair. Thanks, Chairperson. Can I request that with the list of witnesses that are remaining, be discussed in a full committee meeting? Because there's a danger of deciding here in an inquiry on additional witnesses that have not been adopted at the, that have not been discussed at the full portfolio committee. And also the changes of the date on the program that sometimes would clash with the normal portfolio committee meeting with the entities that have been booked for that date for sometimes. It's very difficult to change the date with the entities because they've got their boards meeting, they have other programs. So I would like us to interfere with that. And I request that, can it be done in consultation with the chairperson of the portfolio committee outside of this meeting in terms of the date?
Thank you very much, Chair.
But I have no problem with the Tuesday. The Tuesday for Minister Kikaba. I'm referring to Wednesday. Thank you, Chair.
The chairperson of the committee raised a very much serious concern because on Wednesday, the 14th, we were supposed to meet the Transnet on their annual report. So if we overlook or we want to change that, we therefore have to sit as a committee and change it in the committee meeting. Honorable Dlamini.
No, thanks, Chairperson. I think what the Chairperson is raising on the issue of Wednesday, that's why my suggestion was that Tuesday, let's go full steam. It's the Guptas, the associate, and the minister. The likelihood of the Guptas not coming, that's why let's book them then. Because at least we'll have the minister on Tuesday. And then we've made decisions in terms of how far can we go. We'll see what happens on Wednesday. But at least we know that Tuesday we've got a full day. Because there's no way that Guptas cannot come and the minister cannot come, including to Tuzan. So Tuesday, let them come in that format. You can start early, we run throughout. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Honorable Dlamini. I think that we understand what he is saying, that on Tuesday we've got a whole day. We will write a letter to the Chair of Chairs and maybe ask for extra time for us to deal with all of them on Tuesday, starting with the Minister and going to the Associates. We will be able to go to the late hours, and then we'll be able to come and attend to the committee meeting on Wednesday. Thank you very much, honourable members. That then we don't interfere with the program of the committee. The other thing that we need to look at, honourable members, because last time when we adopted the program, we said Wednesday next week, the 13th, that is on Tuesday, it is going to be our last day on wrapping up the work of the inquiry into ESCOM. There are other issues that have come up now. We will look at those issues if it is necessary. We need to wrap up the issue of the ESCOM inquiry. We still have a lot of work to do. There are things that are happening in other entities. There are entities who has never, since 2014, come and present their annual reports to us. So we need to look at those things also. We are in a very tight corner. 2019 is here. And we immediately, the electioneering vibe starts. We will not be able to come and sit here in Parliament during our recess period and constituency period. So please, whatever we are thinking about, we must also think of the program of Parliament and our program as committee. Next week, we are only sitting on Tuesday for all the interactions that we are going to have. They are going to have them on Tuesday up until they finish. Then we have our normal committee meeting on Wednesday. That's the resolution that we are taking here as this committee. We will look at the issue of Salim Issa and the Mr. Woods. How do we deal with it? before we start with the inquiry on other part, but we need to wrap up this program of ESCOM. There's also something that came out of the, remember the chairperson, every time she speaks in the inquiry, she would ask about the middle management. Because middle management in a company, that's where things happen. That's where the implementation lies. And we have never had a middle manager from ESCOM who is an implementer that has come to the committee. I'm just throwing that to you so that you just digest it and come up with suggestion. How do we deal with it? But it cannot be today. It can be some other day. Honorable Swart.
Chair, just in that regard, there was a letter from 300 middle managers that was addressed to the minister, and I think we might have got copies of that at some stage. So,
which minister? Remember, are speaking about so many ministers.
It could be, but I'll have to ascertain. It was to then, I think, to public enterprises, or we might have been copied with it. I'm not sure, but we can find the copy of that letter. Can I just say, as we're speaking about winding up, I appreciate that today there's, maybe we can also get the information from the Minerals Portfolio Committee that is meeting with the minister about the state of the optimum mines that's featured prominently here, and the Justice Committee is meeting with the NPA and the Hawks and the police on the Guptas, the Stena, and possibly the McKinsey Trillion matter. So we might want feedback from those committees. Just the documentation might be helpful for our deliberations, Chair. Thank you.
Honourable,
I've requested that we separate issues. There are issues that we need to discuss at the portfolio committee meeting. And I'm pleading. Because the danger is that we are going to go now beyond 8 months with this inquiry. The inquiry resolution decision taken in August started the process and preparations between August to October, from October to end of March is 6 months, plus that 2 months from August to October is 8 months, and we need to wrap up this inquiry. And otherwise this portfolio committee will be just an inquiry portfolio committee. And I'm pleading with members, let's park all these issues now. Let's get into the inquiry business and park the business of the full portfolio committee meeting for the next. If you would like us to add on the agenda, that is practically possible. After having seen the entity, we get into some kind of other agenda issues that members are. That relate to inquiry. But I'm pleading with you, Chair, now to get into the business of the day. Thank you.
Well, Honourable Mazon.
Chair, I'd like to agree with my colleague. We have to wrap this inquiry up. The country is now expecting a report, and we have to tell Parliament what actions we expect to see happen now. We could theoretically continue for another 3 years investigating everybody that was implicated in the state capture. That wasn't the purpose of this. We were investigating the main players and the main people that have been involved, and other committees are doing their jobs, and we must leave those committees to do their jobs. This committee now has this job of finishing up this ESCOM inquiry, and it is now time that we wrap it up and present our findings and our recommendations to Parliament. Chair, next week we meet with the so-called really big players in all of this. And, Chair, I don't see a reason why we couldn't, as a committee, start looking at wrapping this up at the very least by the last week of March and presenting our findings to Parliament. The country needs a definitive action from this committee now.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members. Then we will just follow that route that we have put down. If we agree, as these members, that we need to wrap up, last week should be our last interaction. That is why I said, We will see how do we go about with any other thing that comes up. We will discuss that in a portfolio committee meeting. For now, honourable members, thank you very much for your interaction on the announcements that we had. Now today we are going to meet Mr. Ngubane, the former Dr. Ngubane, the former chairperson of Eskom board, he is going to take an oath, I am told. If it's correct, yes, he's going to take an oath. And after that, taking an oath, we will therefore give over to the evidence leader so that he lead us with questions, and then we interact with Dr. Ngubane's presentation. He will give us his presentation, and then after the presentation, the advocate will lead us with questions, and then after the questions of the advocate, we take over as committee members. Thank you very much. You've got the copy of the oath in front of you. Yes, I will be now reading the oath. In accordance with Section 16 of the Powers, Privileges and Immunities of Parliament and Provincial Legislature Act 2004, as a witness to this oversight inquiry, please be informed that by law you are required to answer fully and satisfactorily all the questions lawfully put to you, or to produce any documents that you are required to produce in connection with the subject matter of the inquiry, notwithstanding the fact that the answer or the document could incriminate you or expose you to criminal or civil proceedings and or damages. You are, however, protected in that evidence given under oath or affirmation before a house or committee may not be used against you in any court or place outside Parliament, except in criminal proceedings concerning a charge of perjury or charge relating to the evidence or documents required in these proceedings. Please be aware that in terms of Section 17(2) of the Powers, Privileges and Immunities of Parliament and Provincial Legislature Act, a person who willfully vanishes a house or committee with information or makes a statement before it which is false or misleading commits an offence and is liable to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 2 years. You are therefore required to take the oath. Over to you, Dr. Ngubane. The last page has got the oath. Can you raise your right hand, please?
I swear that the evidence I shall give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help me God.
Thank you very much. You therefore sign the document. Can somebody help Dr. Ngubane to show him where to sign? There. Signed already. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Honorable members, I want to bring to your attention that for the past 3 or 4 weeks or so, if I'm not mistaken, or a month, can we deal with that chaos at the back there? Can we deal with it when we are done? That is of no interest to the communities. Dr. Ngubane has sent several letters of apologies, and in his apologies, he stated that he is not well. I just want that to be noted, that he stated that he is not well, so that we know that we are dealing with you, Mr. Ngubane, and you are healthy, you are well to be seated in this and in this committee and interact with us. We don't want to interfere with your health, and later on we are then charged of that. We hope that today you are well. For the fact that you came to the committee personally, we think that you are very well. And thank you for coming, and thank you for accepting the invitation from the committee. Advocate, can I give over to Mr. Ngubane to present?
Yes, Chair. There's one or two issues, perhaps, just to guide the process going forward. Doc, good morning. The committee received your detailed submission with annexes. The better part, the first half of your submission, you deal with the topics that were given to you by the committee to respond to. And it would appear from your submission, and I must say also common sense would agree with your submission, that these were areas that you were not personally involved in. They would either come to you through, or at board level, if any, some of these would not even come to you at board level. And it would appear that your recollection would have been based on minutes of those meetings. For the sake of progress, and I've discussed this with your legal representative, I'm not sure to what extent have you engaged with him on that. But if you're comfortable with the approach, I would suggest that we do not dwell too much on the first part of your statement, but rather focus on those areas in your statement where you were personally involved. That, from my reading of your statement, will start somewhere in the middle of your statement where you deal with, I think, the suspension of the four executives. That's how I propose that we proceed, but it is subject to yourself. I don't know how comfortable you are, but certainly the committee would not have time to allow you to read the entire submission verbatim. Over to you.
Thank you, Advocate Chairperson, and honorable members. I must apologize. It took longer than I thought it would to come from the airport to Parliament. Sorry for that. I hear what the advocate is saying, but I would like the whole record, of the whole document, to be taken as record, because these are the issues I was informed about, and so I concentrated on finding documentation and material on those issues. However, I'm quite happy to start off, as you have suggested, with the issue of suspension of the executives.
Just to say that we can confirm that we did receive the document. Some of us, we had an opportunity to read the whole document. We are aware what is contained on the document, and we support the proposal that is made by the evidence leader to where to start with the interaction. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. You can follow what the evidence leader has said, and just find the page. We'll give you time to find the page where you will have to start.
We came into ESCOM somewhere in December, just before Christmas. We had our first meeting in March, to which we were summoned by the then chairperson of ESCOM, Mr. Sosi. I think it was a Sunday evening that we got the message that the following day we should come to a port meeting. There wasn't much, except that he wanted us.
Can I just request Dr. Ngubane just to, when he says December or somewhere in March, just to put the year so that we can follow properly on what he's talking about.
Check the... Sorry.
24.
2.3, which is taken from the letter of invitation. The circumstances surrounding the suspension of Messrs. Sediso Matona, Machela Kogo, Dan Morokane, and Ms. Chelofelo Molefe, and the reasons for the termination of service of the various executives who left Eskom. When I will read this then, just to be sure that I pick up everything. 2.3.1, this matter falls outside of my tenure as the former chairperson of the board. My understanding is that Mr. Tsosi, in his capacity then as the chairperson of the board, motivated for the board to urgently authorize the appointment of an independent investigation to be conducted by an external service provider. 2.3.2, it is also my understanding that Mr. Tsosi motivated for the suspension of certain key executives whilst the investigation was being conducted. Apparently, he had suspected such executives of wrongdoing. 2.3.3, the affected positions included those of the group chief executive officer, namely Mr. Sediso Matona, Mr. Matona, group executive commercial and technology, namely Mr. Machela Koko, Mr. Koko, group executive group capital, namely Mr. Dan Marokane, Mr. Marokane, and the finance director, namely Mr. Cholofelo Molefe, MS Molefe, respectively. 2.3.4, the investigation was eventually conducted, but on different terms to those which Mr. Tsosi had initially proposed to the board. The investigation was undertaken by a different service provider, namely Denton's attorneys, and not Mr. Nick Linnell, who had been appointed by Mr. Tsosi. 2.3.5, after the investigation was concluded, however, Mr. Matona, who had filed a labor dispute case against Eskom, negotiated and settled his dispute out of court and left Eskom. Mr. Marokane, Ms. Molefe, also left the employ of Eskom. Only Mr. Koko returned to his position at Eskom. That deals with the issue that the advocate had raised. I'm not sure whether I should continue with the other issues. 2.4, the employment of Mr. Brian Molefe as group chief executive at Eskom. Mr. Molefe was secretary of Eskom as the acting group chief executive officer, the GCEO, on 17 April 2015 for a period of 3 months. Prior to his secondment to Eskom, Mr. Molefe was the group chief executive at Transnet. On 23 June 2015, I addressed a letter to the Minister Lynn Brown requesting her support and endorsement for the extension of Mr. Molefe's secondment as acting group chief executive for a further period of 3 months. Two further aspects were also contained in the letter, namely that A, the People and Governance Committee, PNG Committee, had resolved to seek the full-time appointment of Mr. Molefe to the position of Group Chief Executive, and B, Ms. Vernette Klein, Ms. Klein, was tasked with procuring a legal opinion on the most optimal approach to follow to give effect to the appointment of Mr. Molefe. 2.4.3, the legal opinion was obtained from Bowman Gelfelin on 18 June 2015. Such opinion concluded that Eskom could appoint a group chief executive without having to conduct an external search process, and that the board could provide the minister with a short list of one candidate only whom the minister could elect whether to appoint or not. 2.4.4, on 27 June 2015, the minister responded to my letter. In essence, the minister agreed to the request for the extension of Mr. Molefe's secondment and also requested the board to deal expeditiously with the appointment of a new group chief executive officer in accordance with Eskom's Memorandum of Incorporation, Labor Relations Act, and Eskom's employment policies and procedures. The minister also requested to be provided with a copy of the complete legal opinion obtained. 2.4.5, On 13 September 2015, the legal opinion was transmitted by Ms. Suzanne Daniels, Ms. Daniels, to Ms. Osila Ruthman, Ms. Ruthman, who was then Chief Director, Governance of the Legal and Governance Department at the Department of Public Enterprises. 2.4.6. On 14 September 2015, Ms. Ruthnam responded to Ms. Daniels and inquired whether or not Bowman's had considered the guidelines for the appointment of a chief executive officer for a state-owned enterprise. Ms. Ruthnam also enclosed a copy of the guidelines in a communication to Ms. Daniels. 2.4.7. On the same day, the above-mentioned guidelines were sent to Bowman's for a supplementary opinion. The issue to be reconsidered being whether or not, in light of the provision of the guidelines, the proposed process of appointing Mr. Molefe on a permanent basis as Group Chief Executive was competent. 2.4.8. On 15 September 2015, the supplementary opinion was received. In that opinion, Bowman's advised that the board was actually required to make recommendations to the minister on the top three candidates in the order of priority, and that any proposed deviation from that requirement required the board to notify the minister in writing together with the reasons for the deviation. On 16 September 2015, the supplementary opinion was forwarded to Ms. Ruthnam. 2.4.9. Ms. Klein subsequently submitted a notification of ESCOM's departure from the application of the guidelines by way of a letter to the minister. I understand the letter was sent to her office by Ms. Daniels on 16 September 2015 with a signed version following thereafter on 23 September 2015. I also understand that the minister did not object to the departure. 2.4.10. On 10 September 2015, the board resolved that the People and Governance Committee should submit a recommendation to the minister around the appointment of Ms. Molefe as Group Chief Executive. On 11 September 2015, and pursuant to the aforesaid resolution, I addressed a letter to the minister advising her of the board's resolution to propose permanently employing Mr. Molefe as Group Chief Executive. A draft employment contract was annexed to the letter for the minister's consideration and approval. I attach here to a copy of the said letter marked BN9. 2.4.11. On the 2nd October 2015, the minister approved the appointment of Mr. Molefe as Group Chief Executive Officer. In this regard, the minister addressed a letter to me copying Ms. Klein, and also enclosing letters addressed to Mr. Molefe and to Mr. Anuj Singh, Mr. Singh. The letters confirmed their appointments as Group Chief Executive Officer and Chief Financial Officer, CFO, respectively, with effect from 1st October 2015. However, there was no indication of the duration of their respective appointments contained in such letters. Copies of the said letters are attached marked BN10. 2.4.12, on 7 October 2015, a permanent contract of employment was prepared based on the inference drawn from the minister's letter dated 2nd October 2015 and addressed to Mr. Molefe. In that, no mention of a fixed-term employment contract was made in the letter. 2.4.13, on 8 October 2015, Ms. Klein received an email from Ms. Daniels drawing her attention to the exchange of email communication between Ms. Daniels and Ms. Ruthnam regarding the term of appointment of Mr. Molefe. Ms. Ruthnam advised that the minister had approved a 5-year term for Mr. Molefe. Ms. Daniels had requested that Ms. Ruthnam verify this, as Mr. Molefe's appointment letter had not stipulated a 5-year term, and secondly, that all previous group chief executives at ESCOM were appointed on a permanent basis. Ms. Ruthnam advised that the 5-year term was a cabinet requirement.
Nonetheless, she said she would revert on whether or not the minister would need to address the board on the issue. According to Ms. Klein, she received no further correspondence on the issue, and under the circumstances, presumed the issue was resolved. 2.4.14. On 16 October 2015, I addressed a letter to the minister on the proposed terms of Mr. Molefe's appointment and remuneration. The contents of the letter were informed by various inputs. The People and Governance Committee had taken figures from Mercer surveys, from PE corporate surveys, and from Deloitte surveys on chief executive remuneration packages. The board's understanding was that Mr. Molefe's employment would be on a permanent basis. 2.4.15, on 1st November 2015, the minister responded to my letter of 16 October 2015, in which she approved the proposed remuneration package for Mr. Molefe. A copy of the minister's approval is attached here to SBN 11. The minister further recorded that the term of Mr. Molefe's appointment was a period of 5 years, subject to annual performance reviews. The minister's letter was addressed to me as the then chairperson of the board and was received by Ms. Daniels on 4th November 2015. 2.4.16, on 9 November 2015, I presented Mr. Molefe with a permanent contract of employment. For some reason or other, the minister's letter dated 4 November 2015 sent to me and received by Ms. Daniels did not come to my attention or the attention of the board. 2.4.17, on 12 November 2015, Ms. Klein received an email from Ms. Daniels enclosing a draft offer of employment letter dated 13 October 2015, which specified that Mr. Molefe would enter into a fixed-term employment contract with ESCOM, but the term was not specified. The minister approved the proposed remuneration, but confirmed that the term of employment would be for a fixed term of 5 years, and the board was tasked with the challenge of having to change the signed permanent contract to a 5-year fixed term contract. On about 16 November 2015, Mr. Molefe was advised of the minister's decision, and various retirement issues were discussed between Mr. Molefe and myself. Following such discussions, I advised the board that Mr. Molefe was willing to accept the 5-year contract. I also advised the board that Mr. Molefe had, however, expressed concerns and reservations regarding the perceived pension benefit, which he understood to emanate from his permanent employment at ESCOM. 2.5, construction of the pension benefits for Mr. Brian Molefe. 2.5.1, upon considering the impact of losing Mr. Molefe in the event that a resolution could not be reached on the terms of his appointment, Ms. Klein and I sought the guidance of Mr. Minar, Executive Remuneration Officer at ESCOM. Mr. Minar was involved in the appointment of 7 previous group chief executives at ESCOM in the then preceding 6-year period. Mr. Minar advised that all ESCOM previous group chief executives were employed on a permanent contract basis, and that based on the fixed 5-year term contract, Mr. Molefe would not be able to accumulate an equivalent pension benefit during his service at ESCOM. 2.5.2, based upon the above mentioned advice, it was then agreed that an arrangement could be put in place to ensure that Mr. Molefe was not adversely affected in respect of his pension benefits. On 25 November 2015, Mr. Minar assisted me in drafting a letter to the minister recommending that a retirement arrangement be reached with Mr. Molefe in order to allay his pension concerns. A copy of the said letter is attached as BN 12. 2.5.3, The arrangement proposed with the guidance of Ms. Minar was such that 2.5.3.1, regardless of Mr. Molefe's age, after the expiry of his 5-year contract, he would be allowed to retire from ESCOM's service on the basis that he was aged 63. 2.5.3.2, the penalties prescribed by the ESCOM Pension and Provident Fund, EPPF, for retirement prior to the age of 63 would be waived and not payable by Mr. Molefe. ESCOM will then carry the cost of such penalties to be paid over to the ESCOM Pension and Provident Fund. 2.5.3.3, in the event that Mr. Molefe's employment contract was not extended beyond the 5-year period, he would not be allowed to subscribe to any other state-owned companies or government pension fund. And 2.5.3.4, should the employment contract be extended, the cost of any subsequent penalties would decrease proportionately. 2.5.4, the effect of the above-mentioned arrangement was considered to be such that Mr. Molefe would be in the same position that he would have been in had he retired from ESCOM at the age of 63. The board was in support of the arrangement. 2.5.5, on 25 November 2015, the terms of the arrangement were communicated by Ms. Daniels to the Minister's office. Receipt of the said letter was acknowledged and an undertaking made to bring its contents to the Minister's attention. 2.5.6, as at 9 February 2016, however, a formal response to the letter addressed to the Minister has still not been received, and at that time, there was no formal contract of employment with Mr. Molefe. 2.5.7, on 9 February 2016, the People and Governance Committee met to deliberate on the conclusion of a contract of employment with Mr. Molefe, including the issue relating to his pension benefits. In order to better understand the distinction between appointing Mr. Molefe on a fixed term as opposed to a permanent contract basis and the options available to the board for addressing Mr. Molefe's concerns, Mr. Minar guided the board. As already mentioned, Mr. Minar explained to the board that due to Mr. Molefe's short-term contracts with numerous public entities in which he served at executive level, he was deprived of the opportunity to grow a pension fund in a single fund. 2.5.8, it was then resolved at the meeting of 9 February 2016 that 7.5.1, the current ESCOM Pension Provident Fund ruled that employees may proceed on retirement from the age of 50 with 10 years service remains applicable. 7.5.2, in cases where an executive director appointed on a fixed term contract decides to take an early retirement and there is a shortfall regarding the ESCOM Pension and Provident Fund 10 years service rule, ESCOM shall 1. Bridge the gap to make up for the 10 years, 2. Waive the penalties applicable to early retirement, and 3. Refund the ESCOM Pension and Provident Fund actual costs for additional service added, plus penalties applicable to early retirement. 7.5.3, a proposal in respect of the Chief Financial Officer was to be considered and submitted to the committee in due course. A copy of this resolution is attached and marked BN 5.5.9. It was the intention of the People and Governance Committee that the arrangement had to be structured in such a way that the benefit would only accrue to Mr. Molefe upon completion of his 5-year term, and that Mr. Molefe would not be able to participate in any other government pension fund after qualifying as per the resolution. Such intention was communicated to the Minister on 25 November 2017. 2.5.10, on 7 March 2016, Mr. Molefe signed a second contract of employment for a fixed term of 5 years with effect from 1st October 2015 and terminating on 30 September 2020. On 19 April 2016, the board approved the resolution of the People and Governance Committee meeting of 9 February 2016. 2.5.11, on 6 September 2016, it was decided to increase the long-term incentive award for Mr. Mdife to 2 times the annual pensionable earnings on the basis that the amount was relatively low based on the benchmark against similar long-term incentive awards to the chief executives at this level. 2.5.12, on 24 October 2016, the People and Governance Committee approved the additional award in the form of an increase to Mr. Mlife's long-term incentive to 2 times the annual pensionable earnings. 2.6, the eventual payment of pension benefits to Mr. Brian Molife. 2.61, on 11 November 2016, Mr. Mlife formally submitted his request for an early retirement in terms of the ESCOM Pension and Provident Fund rules, read together with the resolution of 9 February 2016. In the same letter, he also indicated that his last day of service will be on 31st December 2016. A copy of the said letter is attached, marked BN14. 2.6.2, on 15 November 2016, the ESCOM Pension and Provident Fund provided an early retirement calculation for Mr. Mlife based on the exit date of 31 December 2016. The total cost to ESCOM for early retirement would be an amount of 25 million. Hang on, there's something wrong here. 25,802,004.19. I think I'm reading it right. 2.6.3. On 21 November 2016, Molefe's retirement was discussed at a special People and Governance Committee meeting. During the meeting, the terms of the letter requesting early retirement were supported. 2.6.4. On 24 November 2016, the response was provided to Mr. Mdife, in which I approved his request for early retirement in terms of Rule 28 and Rule 24.1 of the ESCOM Pension and Provident Fund rules. I also confirmed that all penalties would be waived and further early retirement be on the basis that Molefe be deemed to have achieved the age of 63. A copy of my approval letter is attached hereto, marked BN15. 2.6.5, on 23rd March 2017, the amounts paid to Mr. Mlife in respect of his salary up to December 2016 were 575,679.91, leave due to him in an amount of 226,278.84, and a short-term bonus to the end of December 2016 in the amount of 2,110,185 rand. The total amount paid to Mr. Mlife was the sum of 2,912,143.75. 2.6.6. On 19 April 2017, the minister called a meeting to discuss Mr. Mlife's pension payout. It became evident at this meeting that my letter to the minister dated 25 November 2015 was not accepted by the minister. The minister stated in no uncertain terms that funds in the amount of 30,103,915.62 paid to the ESCOM Pension and Provident Fund in respect of Mr. Molefe's early retirement would not be permissible and should be repaid. 2.67, following the meeting with the minister, Ms. Klein and Ms. Daniels had a meeting later on that evening with Mr. Mlife, where it became apparent that he was already paid out 30% of the pension benefit in January 2017 and was also receiving monthly pension payments of 100,000 rand since then. 2.6.8, according to Mr. Mlife, he only received 7,700,000 from the Eskom Pension and Provident Fund on being admitted to the Eskom Pension and Provident Fund, and of this sum, 4,300,000 had been transferred from the Transnet Pension Fund to the Eskom Pension and Provident Fund. The employment 2.7. The employment of Mr. Singh as financial director at Eskom. 2.7.1. On 1st August 2015, Mr. Singh assumed the role of CFO at Eskom on secondment from Transnet, where he had held the position of CFO from about July 2012, having acted as a CFO since about 2005. 2.7.2. On 28 September 2015, the minister announced that Cabinet approved the appointment of Mr. Singh as the CFO at Eskom in conjunction with Mr. Molefe's appointment as Group Chief Executive and my appointment as Chairman. 2.7.3. On 2nd October 2015, when the minister approved the appointment of Mr. Molefe as Group Chief Executive and addressed a letter to me in this effect, a copy of Mr. Singh's appointment letter was also enclosed therein. The letter confirmed Mr. Singh's appointment as CFO from 1st October 2015. However, there was no indication of the duration of his appointment. Please also see paragraph 2.4.11. 2.8. Eskom's response to the Public Protector's report on the state of capture, dated 14 October 2016. 2.8.1. The responses to issues that were raised by the Public Protector during an investigation were prepared by and submitted to the Public Protector by the Company Secretary and Head of Legal Services, Ms. Daniels. 2.8.2. The Board did not respond to the Public Protector's report, but we had a draft on this, which I hope has been circulated, of our response. When the report was published and made available to the Board sought and obtained legal advice and guidance from senior counsel on what its rights and obligations were. In particular, the Board sought guidance as to whether or not it could take the report on review on the basis that the Public Protector had not given the Board and or any of the individual directors specifically mentioned in the report an opportunity to respond to the issues raised therein in relation to them. 2.8.3, Senior Counsel's opinion was that the Public Protector's report did not contain any findings, but instead it contained what he referred to as being observations. On that basis, he opined the report could not be taken on review. 2.8.4, in amplification of his views, Senior Counsel pointed out that the primary remedial measure employed by the Public Protector's report was that a judicial commission of inquiry had to be established, and that this remedy fits logically and appropriately with an investigation that was not as detailed as it might otherwise have been. 2.8.5, in other words, as counsel concluded, the impact of the report was to record a number of potential violations of law based on the information that was made available to the Public Protector, and the call for a commission of inquiry to be appointed to make the final findings on these allegations of unlawful conduct. 2.8.6, the Board accepted Senior Counsel's advice. Hence, no further action was taken in relation to the Public Protector's report. I think this is the end of the issues that we agreed I should address.
Just deal with the 2.9, Doc.
Yes. All right. 2.9, the purchase of Optimum Coal Holdings by Tegeta from Glencoe. This is not an issue that I was engaged in. but I collected as much information as I could, and that's what I'm presenting. 2.9.1, prepatches of coal from Optimum. 2.9.11, on 8 December 2015, a round-robin resolution was submitted to the board by management. The submission was titled Prepatches of Coal from Optimum Coal Mine. That part of it I was involved in. 2.9.1, the motivation for the round-robin dealt with the security of coal supply to the Hendrina Power Station in light of the fact that Optimum Coal Mine was placed under business rescue. 2.9.13, as part of motivating for this transaction, Mr. Machela Koko indicated that given the serious risk of security of supply to Hendrina Power Station, Komati Power Station, and Arnold Power Station, all of which are of key national interest, he considered it appropriate to bring this to the attention of the Director General in the Department of Mineral Resources. Mr. Koko then requested intervention by the Department of Mineral Resources to obtain a resolution of the problem of coal supply. 2.9.1.4, the Director General of the Department of Mineral Resources responded in a letter indicating that they would engage with the parties and take certain steps to assist in considering the significant risk to the country. 2.9.1.5, the Department requested that ESCOM play an active role in supporting the risk rescuing of the mine and return for securing the honoring of the current contract up to 2018, to consider making a prepayment for up to 1 year coal supply. This was to ensure that supply was guaranteed and averting any national crisis. 2.9.16, it was indicated that with the funding of the prepayments of coal, ESCOM was going to achieve a value benefit of 238.9 million rand. The motivation by management further indicated that the proceeds of the 1.86 billion prepayment of coal were to be used by Optimum Coal Mine to extinguish existing liabilities to ensure that the business continues as a going concern. It further stated that the shutdown of Optimum Coal Mine could potentially result in thousands of job losses. 2.9.17, pursuant to the above-mentioned motivation stroke recommendation, the prepurchase of coal was then approved by the board by a round-robin resolution on 9 December 2015 after the Investment and Finance Committee of the board had made the recommendation formally. 2.9.18, based on all the submissions made by management, the board believed that this payment was for the pre-purchase of coal from Optimum Coal Mine. The board only learned from the press in July 2017 that management had, in fact, converted what was meant to be a prepayment for coal into a guarantee. 2.9.1.9, on the 10th of October 2017, Ms. Caroline Henry, who was the senior general manager for the Treasury Department in ESCOM, decided that instead of laying out the 1.6 billion rand in cash, should prepare a note and rather request that a guarantee in favor of Tegeta be issued through APSA. 2.9.1.10, according to Mr. Singh, ESCOM's former CFO, quote, the issuance of this guarantee was brought to the attention of various Treasury officials via emails, who all thus had knowledge that the guarantee was issued. This is over and above Ms. Caroline Henry's, the head of ESCOM's Treasury. By and large, this was the Treasury Exco. This evidences the fact that the issuing of the guarantee was not concealed or kept from the sight of the responsible officials in any way, end quotes. 2.9.2, purchase of Optimum Coal Holdings, Pty Limited, OCH, by Tegeta from Glencoe. 2.9.3, 2.2.1, in December 2015, the sale and purchase agreements for the sale of shares and claims SPA was signed. Together purchased all the shares in the issued share capital of Optimum Coal Mine and purchased claims against Optimum Coal Mine from Optimum Coal Holdings for an amount of $2,100 million. 2.9.22, the suspensive conditions of the SPA were inter alia that 2.9.2.21, Eskom must consent to the sale and purchase of shares by Tegeta. 2.9.222, release of the guarantee provided by Optimum Coal Holdings to Eskom. 2.9.223, Tegeta to issue a guarantee to Eskom in respect of the obligations in the coal supply agreement. And 2.9.224, cession and assignment of rights in the coal supply agreement to Tegeta. 2.9.3. To my knowledge, Eskom was not involved in the purchase of Optimum Coal Holdings by Tegeta, which was a commercial transaction between two private companies, nor the negotiations of the terms of the SPA. The role which was played by Eskom was to secure its interest in the coal supply by Optimum Coal Mine, pre-purchase of coal from Optimum Coal Mine by Eskom. And to that extent, the conditions precedent mentioned above were inserted to protect Eskom's interest. 2.9.4, my understanding is that Eskom's involvement in the sale and purchase of shares and claims by Tegeta from the business risk practitioner of Optimum Coal Mine was limited to the approval of the cession and assignment of coal supply agreement from Optimum Coal Holdings to Tegeta. And this was confirmed by the public protector in page 251 of her report. 2.9.5, my understanding is further that on 8 April 2016, Tegeta made an offer to supply additional coal for the Arnott Power Station from Optimum Coal Mine over a period of 5 months. This offer was made subject to a prepayment to be made by Eskom for the supply of such coal. 2.9.6, the board was advised that the purpose of prepayment was to secure coal for Eskom, more particularly of the high quality that was required by Arnott Power Station, and further to ensure Tegeta's ability to meet the production requirements for both Hendrina and Arnott Power Stations in the short term. 2.9.7, in line with the above, on 11 April 2016, Eskom management approached the board tender committee to consider on an urgent basis the purchase of coal from Tegeta to supply Arnott Power Station for 5 months. The benefits for extending these short-term contracts were presented to the board tender committee as including the following. 2.9.7.1, the fact that the coal was being mined and could be delivered without delay. 2.9.7.2, to alleviate the coal shortfall at Arnott Power Station due to the closure of Arnott Colliery. 2.9.7.3, to alleviate the shortfall of coal requirements at Creel Power Station due to the underperformance of Creel Power Station underground mine. 2.9.74, by procuring this coal for Arnott and Creel Power Stations, it would assist towards building stock days. 2.9.8, the above mentioned requested approval by management was made in terms of Eskom's supply chain procedure, which provides inter alia that whilst Eskom does not encourage the provision of advance payments, an advance payment may be acceptable strategy for Eskom in certain circumstances. For example, 2.9.8.1, in cases where the supplier will have to make a big capital outlay before starting with the contract, and 2.9.8.2, it will only be issued on condition that the relevant contractual provisions relating to advance payments also need to be included in the contract. 2.9.9, the Port Tender Committee approved prepayment to Tegeta in the requested sum of 659,558,079.38. This was inclusive of VAT. The approval was made subject to the following conditions. 2.9.9.1, Eskom had negotiated a 3.5 discount with Tegeta. 2.9.9.2, Tegeta had obtained adequate and appropriate security for the transaction to safeguard Eskom's interests. And 2.9.9.3, Eskom management had provided a rationale for the commercial value that the transaction would have for Eskom. 2.9.10, my understanding is that in the Eskom environment, prepayment of this nature is not necessarily unique and has been done in the past. It forms part of the procurement mandate approved by the Board Tender Committee in 2008. It is used in large projects, coal mining contracts, and emergency supply contracts. 2.9.11, in this regard, it is also noteworthy that in her report, the public protector stated, quote, after evaluating the responses received from Eskom, it is clear that they do have the requisite policies in place which provide for a prepayment of coal to be made. This is in line with various agreements put in place by Eskom after the energy crisis in 2008, close quotes. 2.9.12, however, the public protector also made the comment, quote, that Eskom had previously done extensive due diligence on the Optimum Coal Mine, which formed part of the cooperation agreement. They were aware of the exact production outputs for coal and the price of coal being supplied by Optimum Coal Mine. At that time of concluding the contract with Tegeta for the supply of coal to Arnold Power Station, Eskom was fully aware that the sale of all shares in Optimum Coal Holdings to Tegeta had not gone through. It appears to not make commercial sense for Eskom to contract with Tegeta for a higher price of coal, knowing exactly where the coal was being received from, close quotes. To that end, I point out that a preliminary legal opinion obtained by Eskom on this transaction indicated that Eskom was not in contravention of the PFMA in executing this transaction, as it related the provision related to irregular and fruitless and wasteful expenditure. Financial sustainability is the overarching objective of the Eskom coal strategy, namely optimized value from the existing cost plus mines, para 8.2 to 8.4. Conclusion, I trust that this submission will assist the committee in the finalization of its inquiry. Signed by me on the 5th of March
2018. Thank you, Dr. Ngubane, for the presentation. I would now give over to the advocate to lead us in questioning.
Can you just switch off the mic, please? I'm not going to cover a number of issues with you, Doc. I'm going to pursue three. Firstly, I would like to confirm that your statement forms part of the record of proceedings in its entirety together with annexes. Secondly, I just want to go back to a meeting that took place last year, the 2nd of March, 2017. wherein the board, it was a special board meeting you were chairing.
I think it was a PNG meeting on the 2nd of March.
Okay. What were the issues that you discussed at that meeting?
I think there were a couple of issues touching upon the recruitment process and other PNG issues. However, I brought to that meeting a document that I found on my desk, which was not dated, not signed, putting certain allegations about Mr. Machela Cook. I gave this to the board members, and we came to the conclusion that we had to give this document to Mr. Koko and ask him to respond by end of the working day to what was raised. The statement was duly given to Mr. Koko. Somewhere in the afternoon, before the scheduled meeting, he came to me and said, well, of course, this timing was not sufficient. But he also told me that he was facing a lot of difficulties acting group chief executive because he was moving people around at Medupi and Kusile because of certain serious issues. He didn't go much into the issues, but he mentioned things like fictitious companies were being created and funded. But he was handling this as a group chief executive together with Eskom Security. And then I went back to my colleagues. When we came to the meeting at about 6, I think, the intention was to suspend Mr. Koko and institute an inquiry. But in our discussions, it emerged that actually we needed to give him 48 hours for a response before you can suspend a person. And of course, the issue that there was no name to the document raised the issue of this being not a grievance letter, but a whistleblower document. Now I was reminded that ESCOM policy requires whistleblowers to be dealt with through the Audit and Risk Committee and through the Assurance and Forensic Division of Internal Audit. We then took a decision to submit this document to the Audit and Risk Committee, who subsequently dealt with it through Assurance and Forensic, and this led to the inquiry that eventually took place.
The subsequent chair or acting chair of the board testified here around this particular issue that it was your unilateral decision not to suspend Mr. Koko, that is Mr. Zetemba Koza. What is your response to that?
Well, I don't know where he takes this from, because we had a meeting and we discussed this matter quite extensively. And then I said, well, let's refer this thing to Audit and Risk and let it be handled as a whistleblower document. So there was no time when I took a decision alone. We're all at a meeting.
So, We do have on record the meeting in question. And if you want, we could play the meeting. It was very clear that meeting that it was not only the complaint that you had received, but rather most members of the board had received various complaints in respect of the same individual. But what that meeting was clear on was that there will be a meeting at 6 o'clock and Mr. Koko would be called in at 6 o'clock to give reasons as to why he would not be suspended. Is that your recollection of the resolution of that earlier meeting?
That is correct.
Now, your testimony is that out of the meeting you went to meet Mr. Koko.
After I received the document to which he had to respond, he then asked to see me.
I guess you didn't know what he wanted to see you in connection with.
I assume that it was because of the document that he had received and had to respond to. So I granted him the meeting.
Sorry, you've lost me a bit. You assumed it was in connection with a document he would have received.
No, he got a document to which he had to respond, or else face suspension.
How did he get the document?
It wasn't me who delivered, if I remember well, personally. But, you know, there are people at ESCOM so who do those issues like sending messages and so on. I'm not sure of the precise mechanism.
I guess the question is, on whose instruction was that document sent to Mr. Koko?
It was the decision of the meeting that we had earlier where we decided that he must respond or face suspension.
I recap the decision of that meeting to which you agreed. He was to be called at 6 o'clock to provide reasons as to why he should not be suspended. So in other words, at 6 o'clock, he comes to a meeting, he's given reasons for the allegations against him, and he's told to respond to those allegations.
Well, probably your tape puts it differently. The earlier meeting took the decision that we must get a response from him in terms of the allegations. And the decision then was that he will be suspended if those reasons or responses are not to the satisfaction of us as PNG and the board.
That record would show that you people had already taken a decision to suspend him until you were persuaded by Mr. Zetemba Khoza to call that meeting at 6 o'clock wherein he will be given an opportunity to respond in the same manner when you called the meeting on the 11th of March to suspend Messaries Machela Koko, Mr. Tsidiso Matona, Ms. Tsuluvelo Molefe. That is that's the process that you followed, isn't it?
I mean, that was a totally different process, which was brought upon us. This one was by us to say, here is a document with serious allegations. He must give a response to us
and the document was sent to him so that he can give a response, and then if we are not satisfied, we will suspend him.
That record is very clear. It's not been disputed by any of the other board members that attended the meeting. You had made up your mind, having been persuaded by other board members, yourself included. You wanted him gone, as in yesterday, until you were persuaded by Mr. Koza at 2 o'clock. What is it that persuaded you personally from what Mr. Koza told, resulting in you not suspending him?
Well, the issue of time, was raised for the first time, that actually to suspend we need to give a person 48 hours to respond why the person should not be suspended. That arose for the first time in my meeting with him.
What is the other reason besides the 48-hour notice that stopped you from suspending him, if any?
Well, this was a dynamic process. You know, you may have in your minutes formal discussions, but I mean, we're all at Megawatt Park. We're all talking about this. And it was clear that we had also omitted the policy requirement that this thing must go to audit and risk, who must deal with it through forensic assurance and forensic. It's a policy at ESCOM. So to suspend him directly on a whistleblower note without going through this process would have been illegal.
So that this was the whistleblower, you took that into consideration. What other factors you took into account to arrive at that decision? Any, of course.
This was part of the discussions that we're having. And so, I mean, obviously it would have taken us to court, to the CCMA and Labour Court, and won if we took steps that were not in law or in police.
So to add to the reasons, it was a threat of litigation. Now let's look at these three reasons that you've advanced to entertain how rational your decision was. One.
Advocate, it wasn't just my decision. We were there as members of the board who are also members of PNG. I did not just say no suspension anymore. You know, it was a product of our consultation.
I take your evidence to the extent that you're making that, you're testifying on that. But I need to take into account what other board members have said as well. But on your version that it was a collective decision, it is now before, let me put it this way, 48 hours had elapsed and you had not suspended him. So we can tick that off as not the reason why he was not eventually suspended. Because the 48 hours did come. It went and he was not suspended. So we can tick that off.
No. 48 hours, by that time we had referred the matter to the Audit and Risk Committee, who then took it further and eventually led to dealing with the issue.
But after 48 hours, he had not been suspended.
That's correct.
who was the chairperson of Audit and Risk? Was it not Ms. Mabunda?
That's correct.
She was at the meeting, the earlier meeting of the People and Governance meeting.
That's correct.
She was also vocal that Mr. Gogo had to go.
Correct.
Over and above the whistleblower report, there were other issues that you had raised, including yourself. You had a note from a meeting between yourself and the minister, where the minister had raised serious concerns about the same individual. Is that not correct?
That's correct.
Why were those factors not considered, which you considered at the meeting as part of reasons to suspend him? Is that not correct?
Absolutely.
So why did that package of other issues, except the whistleblowing, which formed part of your decision to suspend him, not stand at the 6 o'clock meeting to suspend him, barring the whistleblower?
Well, I don't have the copy of the whistleblower document before me, but there were many issues raised in that document, you know, and it was the collectiveness of those issues that made us decide to suspend it.
Let's for once.
And also, let me just add, I shared the note from the minister with these same board members. We had shared that information. And we knew that it was something that has got to be dealt with.
The point I'm making, Doc, you had received this whistleblower note, which you had shared with that meeting of the People and Governance earlier in the day. Correct?
That's correct.
Over and above that document, you contributed other reasons why he should go. You've just admitted to that.
That's correct.
Ms. Mabunda contributed additional reasons why the man had to be suspended.
That's correct.
Ms. Clay, who said you people must stop pussyfooting around this man, advanced reasons as to why he had to go. Correct?
That's correct.
Now, in your meeting with Mr. Gogo, and one of the reasons you did not suspend was because of the report, the whistleblower report. I'm saying, I understand that, put it aside. Why, when you at that meeting, based on the contributions of yourself, Ms. Clay, Ms. Mabunda, and others at the meeting, which made you to come to the conclusion that he must go, why did you not, on the basis of those, at that meeting, suspend him?
But I've said, Advocate, that the issues contained in this document encompassed a lot of other matters. However, even if it was on a single issue that had been seen on its own separately, you still have to follow procedure in suspending a person. But here was a document which contained a whole lot of allegations that we're looking at, and then deciding that this thing has got to follow the route of the whistleblower. We did not pick out individual items that we had heard from or discussed before. We were looking at that document which contained these allegations.
We dealt with the 48-hour issue. We dealt with the reasons in terms of eliminating. There's only one reason, it is the threat of litigation. That same board, and I heard your response earlier on and as to how you treated Tsidiso Matona, Molefe, and others differently. But you still maintain it was still the same ESCOM policy applied by the same board. How could you explain the different standards that your board applied to different people?
Well, Advocate, you are bringing me to a more complex situation. When Chairman Sozi said the four people must be suspended, we differed with him because he did not give us cogent reasons as to why these people must be suspended. We even, and remember this was our very first meeting as a new board in March, we said the reasons he was giving us were defamatory, very unsubstantiated. We could not suspend them. We suggested that they take special leave while the concerns he had raised were being investigated. It was the head of legal that he brought into the meeting who said special leave only applies in special cases, not just for investigation purposes. And that's how we ultimately agreed to go with the suspension. But by the way, our resistance to that led to him calling in the minister on the 13th of March to our meeting, where we voiced our concerns. But the minister, while not saying suspend the people, also raised their concerns. The concerns were from the war room, which was claiming it wasn't receiving consistent information from management at ESCOM, therefore they could not develop strategies to turn around ESCOM and stop load shedding. After that, we said, all right, we will go on with the investigation, but of course, the people concerned who are heading the departments that had to be investigated must be put aside for 3 months. It was clearly stated this was going to be for 3 months. They will be informed of the outcome of the investigation. And that's how we took that decision. To substantiate that, on the 14th of July 2015, Mr. Saheed Suleiman, who was the link between the chairperson of the Audit and Risk Committee and Denton's inquiry, wrote this. It was Ms. Kasim who was the chairperson of the Audit and Risk. Dear Ms. Kasim, investigation into the affairs of ESCOM Holdings SOC Limited investigation. 1. I refer to the above. 2. I note that the terms of reference in respect of the investigation do not require that misconduct by any specific individual be investigated. 3. Accordingly, we make no recommendations concerning action against any specific individual. Yours sincerely, signed Saheed Suleiman on behalf of Dentons. That's why I said we were bringing in a very different situation. Here were a set of allegations which were known by all of us. Before, there were nebulous allegations being made, like Mr. Stoltz is saying, Ms. Cholofelo Molefe had contacted people who had tendered during evaluation of tenders. But he never gave, he promised a document that will detail all those allegations. He never did. So we differed with him very seriously. Unfortunately, I don't have those minutes, but it's even minuted. And therefore, the minister was called in.
So the point I'm making is that arising of your decision on the 11th of March, those suspensions, you were taken to court by Tsidiso Matona. What is your answer?
Yes, I was there, the CCMA. I was there, the CCMA, with Mr. Matona. I persuaded him.
Now, we will get to those details. I just want you to confirm that Matona did take you to the Labour Court.
Yes.
As a result of your decision.
Yes.
Okay.
But
then you had subsequent to this incident, after Mr. Molefe came back and you terminated or rescinded your decision to re-employ, you were taken to court. He took you to court, isn't that so?
As far as I know, he took the minister to court, not the board.
The Democratic Alliance took you to court because of your decision, correct?
That's correct.
The Solidarity took you to court on the same decision, correct?
Partly true. Essentially, the DA and Solidarity wanted to block Mr. Molefe's return and him receiving any benefits.
It pertains to your decisions, the point I'm making, it's decisions that you made. The EFF also joined, challenging your decisions. Now, if you couldn't suspend Mr. Mukoko for threat of litigation, why did the same threat of litigation not prohibit you from from taking some of the decisions that you went to court and eventually lost?
You know, I really don't follow, advocate. Here was a situation where we're not given enough time, that the allegations were contained in the whistleblower document. I mean, those were very different circumstances.
Just to make you understand, Doc, so that we move off this point, I'm just entertaining the rationale of this threat of litigation having persuaded you against suspending this person after you had taken a clear decision to suspend him. How sustainable is that in light of the various decisions that you took?
Well, I beg to differ. Circumstances were quite different. Here, we were taking a decision, but not based on legal requirement and on ESCOM policy requirement. We're taking a decision. So if one is made aware that the decision you have taken is not correct, is there anything wrong to following the right procedure? Because we then referred it to the Audit and Risk Committee to deal with it. It wasn't saying this thing is finished and clear, forget it. We took action to proceed, but in a proper way where we would be sure that we followed the rules.
Did you receive a call from the minister, the former Minister of Public Enterprises, not to suspend Mr. Koko on the day?
No. We had met almost half the day or almost all the day talking about this matter. So nobody, the minister, I did receive the minister used to call me quite often, particularly when she finished work in parliament or whatever, to ask me about what was happening at ESCOM, because there were huge numbers of concerns, you know, in terms of stability and so on. So, yeah, she did phone me, but she had phoned me many other times before.
I've asked you a very specific question.
Sorry?
I've asked you a very specific question, Doc. did the minister of the former minister of public enterprises, Ms. Brown, call you at any time between after your earlier meeting where you took a decision you were going to suspend Mr. Gogo and before or during the meeting when you were to suspend Mr. Gogo?
Well, she phoned me. She phoned me, but that was not about Gogo.
It was about what?
It was about Eskom business. I did not keep a note of the conversation I had, but it was about a whole lot of processes that dealt with stability.
You can't recall them?
No, I can't recall. I mean, for instance, there was the issue of, you know, upheavals in some of our power stations. There was the issue of succession. There was the issue of management. Well, actually, if I go back, Mr. Abraham wanted an urgent meeting with me. I was at Tintswalo having another meeting with business people totally unrelated to the business of Eskom. So I said to him, if you say it's so urgent, come and see me. You'll still find me here if you come around 5 or so. He came and told me that he wanted me to intervene because Majela Gogo was forcing him to go to Harvard. Now, Harvard has got a program of upgrading the skills of Eskom people. They go there on rotation. Even Brian Molefe went there to learn about the management of nuclear power stations and so on. So he said, Majela is wanting him to leave his work and go to Harvard. He has got family issues with that. I must intervene to stop because it's causing a problem between him and Majela. Subsequently, I called them both to the meeting. And I said, what is this? Just explain me, why is this man going to go to Harvard at all costs? Majela explained that there's a rotational system. He had ordered Masango to take his slot on the Harvard issue. After a long discussion, Abraham agreed that he was going to go. So I'm just saying, and this was...
I don't have time. The minister called you to discuss business of Eskom. What is it that the minister called you about? Remember now, we had eliminated these calls and meetings with the minister, which are natural and normal. We are between after your midday meeting and the 6 o'clock meeting, where you said the minister called. And I want to know, what is it that the minister called to talk to you about? Don't go around in circles. This is a straightforward question.
No, Advocate, I've told you that this was, to me, a normal call.
Whether it was abnormal, whether it was normal, I want to know the reason. What's so difficult with you saying the minister called wanting me to come to a residence to do this or that? What is difficult with that?
You know, we had a number of meetings with the minister, with the company secretary present, with Ms. Veneta Klein at other times present, to discuss various issues around Eskom. Now, I really don't know what you want me to say.
I give up, Doc. Let's move. There's evidence before this committee that you received a call from the minister on or before that meeting wherein the minister instructed you not to suspend Mr. Gogo. What is your response to that?
Well,
I presume she told this to some people. But she, I mean, I talked to the minister. I was on my phone. It wasn't on speaker. So I don't know where that comes from.
Let's move to, quickly, because I'm running out of time. Just want to move to the employment of Mr. Molefe. On the 18th, page 18, paragraph 2.4.16, on 9 November, page 18, 2.4.16, that is the initial employment of Mr. Molefe when he was page 1.8. You got that? Paragraph 2.4.16. You got that?
Yeah.
On 9 November, you, Dr. Ngubane, presented Mr. Molefe with a permanent contract of employment. That is now after you had written to the minister to try and get the employment of Mr. Molefe sorted out. And you had not received a response from the minister. Why did you write to the minister in the first place around the employment of Mr. Molefe?
Because the minister's rule was that he will only get letters from the chairman. Doesn't matter whether it's BTC or PNG, the letters are to come from the chairman.
Okay. I'm sorry for not coming clear. I understand the protocol. I understand the protocol, part of it. But why, what was the rationale of writing to the minister regarding Mr. Molefe's employment issues?
Because the change from permanent employment to fixed term caused a lot of problems in terms of handling Mr. Molefe's benefits and so on. And therefore, with the possibility of Mr. Molefe going, because he was saying he has lost out a lot from being moved from one organization to the other, PNG worked out a proposal to keep Mr. Molefe at Eskom by all the things that I've enumerated. That
okay, I'm not there yet. Okay. I'm not there yet. I'm at a stage where Mr. Molefe was seconded from Transnet, and then you then recommended that he be appointed permanently, and you had engaged lawyers that advised on the process. Then you wrote to the minister that letter of the 9th of November 2015 about Mr. Molefe's employment. I'm saying, what was the rationale? What is it that you wanted from the minister? Did you want the minister to say, yes, I'm employing this person, or what?
Well, let's go back. Mr. Molefe came at the height of load shedding. Within 3 months of his presence, we started to notice change. The whole mindset at Eskom began to change, where the person at generation was not talking to the person at transmission, was not talking to the person at national control. This changed. There was synchronization of the actions of all the main players. Generation, distribution, national control. You know, it was a significant shift. So the three months were ending, and the rationale was, we cannot remove this man just at this point when we are seeing some progress.
Would it be correct that you wanted the minister to employ Mr. Molive?
No. It was to ask him to extend by 3 months, which he did. But the problem was not completely over then. We're still struggling with new build projects, seriously delayed. We're spending huge amounts of money on diesel. You know, so the program was not completed. So we decided, I wasn't the only one who decided this. It came from PNG, People and Governance. Let's request the minister to keep Molife here because he's doing a good job.
I'm not asking you to justify why you wanted him to be employed. All I'm asking, when you wrote to the minister, when you now have made the decision that you want to keep your man, you wrote to the minister, is that not correct, to engage on the terms of Mr. Molive's employment?
But we had to do that because...
I'm not questioning that.
Oh, but you said the rationale, so this is what I'm trying to give.
Okay. Did you write to the minister, having now the board made a determination that you want to keep your men, you wrote to the minister. Did you, in writing to the minister, did you want to get the minister's approval, or are you just letting the minister know that you've now employed your men?
Well, the minister had to approve this, because it was a deviation from the usual practice.
No, that's fine. That's all that I wanted. But before you received the minister's approval, on the 9th of November, you presented to Mr. Molive a permanent contract of employment. Because you say at that stage you had not received the minister's response. Because you say for some or other reason, the minister's letter dated 4 November sent to me and received by Ms. Daniels did not come to my attention or the attention of the board. Then the question is, why did you offer Mr. Molive a permanent contract of employment when you had not received the approval you sought from the minister?
The sequence is wrong. The minister approved the employment of Mr. Molive. Remember, Ms. Ruthnam, in the minister's office, sent us the guidelines for the appointment. And this was responded to through a second legal advice. And the minister approved.
Let's go to the construction of the pension. You say on 25 November 2015, Mr. Minar assisted me in drafting a letter to the minister recommending that a retirement arrangement be reached with Mr. Molive in order to allay his pension concerns. Now, this is after you became aware that you had to offer Mr. Molive a 5-year fixed-term contract as opposed to the permanent employment. Is that correct? And you had given reasons as to why you had to accommodate Mr. Molive's pension concerns. And rather, you wrote to a letter to the minister motivating why the pension proposals needed to be amended, correct?
That's correct.
At the time that you wrote the letter to the minister, were you aware that the minister, Mr. Molive was previously employed at National Treasury for 7 years?
Yes, I know he moved from National Treasury to PIC, from PIC to Transnet.
Were you aware that he had moved from Treasury where he had spent 7 years? Yes or no?
No, I wasn't aware of the time.
So you would not have looked at his CV when you employed him?
Yes, definitely we did. I knew he was from Treasury too, but I wasn't really cognizant of the number of years he spent there.
But you ought to have known, if you looked at his CV.
Yeah, I'm sure I had at some stage looked at it.
So he knew?
Yeah.
You would have known that he had moved from Treasury to become CEO of PIC for another 7 years.
That's correct.
Further, that you would have worked for an additional 4 years at Transnet, where you recruited him.
That's correct.
And that, was it then your view that he would not have amassed a pension fund? I mean, a pension in those respective roles?
Well, that was the issue he raised. And then we consulted Mr. Minar, and Mr. Minar confirmed that, in fact, he would lose out if he didn't work the full period to reach pensionable age.
Forget about what Minar told you. I'm saying what the information that ought to have been in your minds when you wrote the letter.
That's correct, but you need to verify information when you write such letters.
Did you know what his salary was at Transnet?
Well, offhand, I can't recall that figure.
Offhand, you can't, but you knew at the time how much he earned.
It was not far from what he was earning at Eskom.
You are giving this man a 5-year fixed-term contract at a remuneration package of 7.656 million per annum. Is that correct?
That's correct.
He must have been the highest paid within Eskom.
Not at all. Other CEOs received in that range as permanent Eskom employees.
I'm saying when he was CEO within Eskom employees at the time, he would have been the highest paid.
Well, I can't agree to that because I would need to see the figures again.
And that's fine. I'm saying it's fine. When you took a decision to buy additional 10-year service to increase a pension of somebody who earned 7,600,000 per annum, the total package, who in his previous job would have earned around about 6 million. Did you for once think about those officials at Eskom who earn a very low salary? Did it ever cross your mind that perhaps you had employees that were earning far less than what this man was earning?
But this is, Eskom is both a market company and a state company. So the benchmarks have always been to accommodate that aspect. Molefe's salary was no different in terms of basic packages than all the previous CEOs at Eskom.
the fact that there's such a pay differential in this country between top CEOs and the lowest worker in a company may be a basis of serious inequality, but this is the system in which we operate.
All I'm asking is, at the time when you're considering Mr. Molefe's pension, did you take a minute to think about the other 40-odd employees in relation to the same issue of pension?
Well, Advocate, that is a very unfair and loaded question. I can't come to ESCOM and change the processes there. I don't set the levels of payment at ESCOM, nor in any other state entity. The chairman of the board does not set the levels. He gets that from the system.
You are aware that this matter, the court recently ruled on it.
Certainly.
Let me remind you what the court said. In relation to your board that took the decision. At paragraph 39, this is what three judges are saying. The decision by ESCOM to waive penalties and buy Mr. Molefe an extra 13 years of service, totaling 30.1 million, after only 15 months at the age of 50, stretches incredulity and is unlawful for want of compliance with the rules of the pension fund.
Well, I wonder.
I've not asked you a question, sir. I'm just reading.
Okay.
What is most disturbing, and this is what perhaps you need to take note of, what is most disturbing is the total lack of dignity and shame by people in leadership positions who abuse public funds with naked greed for their own benefit without a moment's consideration of the circumstances of fellow citizens who live in absolute dirt throughout the country with no basic services. What do you want to say to that indictment?
That indictment can apply to Steynholm, to many multinationals in this country, because I agree there's a lot of greed at the expense of the ordinary person. But that's the nature of the state in which we are in. Our clause said if the contract after 5 years, at the end of the 5-year term, is not extended, then we will buy Mr. Molefe an extra number of years to sustain his benefits. It was clearly stated in the resolution.
Let's move on to the meeting of the 9th of February 2016. That's page 20. Paragraph 2.5.7. The meeting of the 9th of February, where you resolved to reconstruct this pension regime for Mr. Molefe. Mr. Molefe was at the meeting, correct? No, he was.
Well, if he was, he would have recused himself. I haven't got the minutes of that meeting, but if he was, we never discussed prescribed officer salaries with them present in the meeting. We always went into committee.
Are you disputing that he was at the meeting where you were discussing his pension benefit?
I would say he could have been in the general meeting, but when it comes to discussing prescribed officers' salaries and remunerations, they always recuse themselves. That is a standing policy. It happens. They might be at the meeting, but when it comes to the point, they get out.
That happens when corporate governance runs supreme in an organization, but where it has collapsed, those things don't happen. What is your comment?
Well, I'm telling you, advocate, this is what we always do.
Let's hear what the court says about that aspect. On paragraph 27, this is what the court says. On 9 February 2016, some 4 months after his appointment as Group Chief Executive Officer, Mr. Molive attended a meeting of the committee of the board of ESCOM, the People and Governance Committee. Mr. Molive was not a member of this committee and did not recuse himself from its deliberations. He says he attended the meeting as an invitee. He, however, failed to disclose his interest in the subject matter of the resolution. That's a collapse of corporate governance. Would you agree?
Well, I would wish to see the minutes of that meeting, because I can't believe that happened. Because every time we discuss salary issues of prescribed officers, they are asked to recuse. There are many minutes of in-committee meetings that were happening at ESCOM. So that, I don't know where it comes from.
I'm saying there is a court judgment where three judges have said what I've just said. And based on what they say, I am putting it to you that this suggests a collapse of corporate governance.
Well, I'm denying that. Let me see the minutes.
That's okay. Sorry for disturbing your process. I just wanted Dr. Ngubane to say it on record that he denies what the court judgment is saying, or he denies the fact that Mr. Molefe was part of the meeting, according to what he understands in the governance of ESCOM. Is that proper?
Chairperson, I'm not disputing what the judges say, because they will say based on the information they have. But what I know is that every time we come to discuss the positions of prescribed officers in terms of remuneration, short-term, long-term incentives, they leave the meeting. That is what we do. This is the practice. And if we looked at all the meetings of ESCOM meetings, minutes of ESCOM meetings where we discuss such issues, they were asked to recuse themselves.
Thank you very much. You can continue, advocate.
Thank you. You are aware that your decision to give Mr. Molefe the early retirement was inconsistent with the ESCOM's pension fund rules?
Well, the guidelines say people can take early retirement when they reach the age 50. Those are the guidelines we got from the administration, from Mr. Minar. We did not say when Molefe applied for his early pension retirement that the clause of 5 years service is eliminated or discarded. We did not say that. Based on the rule that at 50 they can take early retirement, they have to agree to. And based on that rule, I mean, in terms of what we said, the clause that we agreed to of 5 years service had not kicked in.
But why then did you sign that Mr. Molefe was retiring on early retirement in terms of the resolution of the 9th of February 2016, when you knew that the purpose of that resolution, as wrong as it was in law, it was reserved for him after he had served 5 years.
But a person can retire any time in any job once he reaches a certain age. He was 50, but it did not mean that he would get the benefits that he would have got if he had served 5 years.
So is it your contention here today that when you signed a letter to Mr. Molefe, it was not the intention of you or your board that he would be entitled to the ESCOM pension fund?
Absolutely. Was contributing to the pension fund every month. If he reaches 50, which was allowed by ESCOM rules, then he will receive whatever his contribution has been.
Just help me and help the committee in terms of your decision-making process. When you're faced with the matter, do you just receive a briefing, and based on the briefing you say yes or no? Or did you interrogate issues that were brought to you by the managers and apply yourself to those issues?
The issue of his retirement had been dealt with ad nauseam in PNG in letters to the minister. It wasn't a new matter. PNG met, they took a resolution. Mr. Minar came to me with a letter that was coming from that meeting. The company secretary was present at that meeting, so I had no reason to doubt the correctness of it.
Why did, we'll get back to this issue, but why did that People and Governance Committee agree to a pension dispensation on the same issues you'd raised with the minister, and the minister had not provided you a response to it?
I say in some of the documents, the letter setting out the arrangements for Molefe's benefits were stated in the letter sent to the minister. The letter was, the acknowledgement came from the minister's PA. It came from the registrar in the minister's department. There was no reason to question whether the minister therefore is accepted, because it was stated and we were assured that he has received it.
So you assume that the minister had given a go-ahead?
Well, that was the conclusion.
You had testified earlier on that between the two of you, you would interact at any time about anything that related to ESCOM. Before that meeting took a decision, did you pick up a phone and say, Minister, we've written a letter to you, we have not received a response, we're about to make a decision?
No, I didn't do that.
Why?
Because of the acknowledgement that had come from the PA, from the registry, And later, the DG said he had received the letter and spoken to Mr. Anuj Singh about it.
And that, to you, amounts to a ministerial approval?
Well, no, it doesn't amount to that. It amounts to the fact that the minister is aware of what we are doing.
My last parting shot. The relates to this issue of early retirement. If you were thorough and applied yourselves to submissions that are brought to you as a board or a subcommittee of the board, and relying on the rules of the ESCOM Pension Fund, as you did in your letter to Mr. Molive, how did you miss it that he was a temporary employee who did not qualify to be a member of the pension fund?
Well, he was on the pension fund. He was contributing to the pension fund.
I'm asking if you took time. And you earlier on said you've dealt with this thing almost routinely, the issue of constructing this pension fund. And in your mind, you had an idea that he must benefit from the ESCOM pension fund. I'm saying you had the rules in front of you that you quoted extensively. You went to Rule 28. How did you miss the definition section of the rules? How did you miss the portion that talks to eligibility in the rules?
We were considering the end of his tenure after 5 years. That 5-year contract could be extended, in which case he will fit in with everybody else at ESCOM, or if it is not extended, he will not lose out. Therefore, we made that provision.
The last question is, you say in paragraph, on paragraph 2.9.1.8, around the issue of the guarantee, you had approved a prepayment which was later converted into a guarantee, and you learned that from the press. What did your board do on learning about what had transpired?
I was no longer at ESCOM.
Thanks, Chair. No further questions.
Thank you very much, Honorable Advocate Vanara and Dr. Ngubane. Can we just take a break of 10 minutes just to... 10 minutes is too long. 5 minutes. 5 minutes break. 5 minutes break. Thank you. I will now give over to the members to